As globalization accelerates, traditions and customs are increasingly lost as modernization and efficiency homogenize our world. Often, we remain unaware of the small yet extraordinary rituals and cultural treasures that are quietly fading away. Yet somewhere in Sardinia, a woman is among the last to craft one of the world's rarest and most intricate pastas. In Japan, a man preserves a 700-year-old soy sauce recipe. In England, a beekeeper shares her family's news with her bees following an age-old tradition. These are just a few of the remarkable individuals holding tightly to the fragile threads of humanity's rarest traditions. Journalist Elliot Stein dedicates his work to traveling the globe, observing and chronicling the lives of these stewards of ancient practices. Elliot's book, Custodians of Wonder, Ancient Customs, Profound Traditions, and the Last People Keeping Them Alive, preserves these fading customs for future generations. Elliot, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Rick.
You know, I hadn't really considered that, but so often, you know, we hear stories of the first person to do something, the innovators, the pioneers, you know, the ones who move us forward. But more often than not, we don't really notice when the last person to carry on some tradition passes on and that slice of culture or heritage just fades away. It's forgotten. Why does this matter to you?
Thanks for asking that question. I feel like so often we hear stories about the first person to do something, the innovators, the pioneers, the ones who move us forward. But rarely is there a whisper for these final custodians maintaining once upon a time traditions and rites that have shaped the places that we come from. And so when these traditions fade away, a certain part of who we are fades with them. And I feel like it's important to take a moment and pause and reflect on what these traditions have contributed to a place and to people's certain worldview that I think is valuable.
You know, it's an interesting battle, isn't it, Elliot, between appreciation of a cultural tradition and modern practicality. I mean, in some cases, there's no practical rationale for continuing this. I mean, you know, we don't have horse-drawn carriages anymore to go to work. We get in a car. We use electricity or gasoline. Do you think the practicality is sort of the reason that it's a losing battle sometimes to save these things?
There's so many reasons why these once-upon-a-time rites are fading. I mean, it's globalization, it's technology, it's increased ease of travel, and there's also a very strong economic force, too. One of the final custodians in this book told me very flatly, you can't make a living doing this thing anymore. There's just no future in it.
One of your chapters is The Last Watchman in Scandinavia. Well, there's a good... I mean, if I was the son of the last watchman in Scandinavia, I'm not sure I'd want to do what my dad's going to do.
So yeah, in there's a southern town in Sweden facing the Baltic Sea called Ystad, and it's a gorgeous place. It's cobblestone streets. It's these pastel-colored bungalows. And then there's this striking church tower in the center of it. And from every part of this town, you can see the church tower. And for the past 500 years, there's been a night watchman who climbs up 103 steps to the top of a church tower. And for the past 100 years, that person has been a Borg. The person who is the custodian today is named Roland Borg. His father was the night watchman before him. His grandfather was the night watchman before him. And his single wish in life is that his son will carry on this tradition that has represented so much to this community and to this family. But it's an hourly position. The hours are terrible. The pay is not great. And this custodian's son has two children to take care of. So what has he done? He's become effectively a modern night watchman and is now a security guard at a mall. The hours are better. He makes more money. And to your point about economics, it's what he has to do these days to provide for his family and to make a living.
You know what the younger Borg could do is keep it alive thanks to tourism. I mean, I know a town in Denmark where there's a wonderful night watchman. And maybe his grandpa did it for real, but he's doing it because 50 people give him $10 every night, and that's a living.
Yeah, it's a great point you make. And one of the things that I noticed in reporting these stories is that there's a really fine line between maintaining a tradition and modernizing, or in a certain sense, even commodifying it. So, you know, once you start leading tours and kind of making your rounds, as a lot of these watchmen reenactors say, is that really being a night watchman anymore? Or is it sort of putting on the tunic and carrying the lantern and recreating this thing that used to be? So one of the things that I find remarkable about this tradition in Sweden is that it exists in essentially the exact same way that it always has. there's a single phone line that exists in the night watchman's tower where that connects to the fire department. There's almost no heating in there. You freeze your behind off when you're up in these Swedish winters and up in the tiny hovel. But every 15 minutes, like clockwork, Roland puts his trumpet out the church tower window and in a north, south, east, west direction blows a haunting bugle cry over the rooftops of this town to reassure the 29,000 people in this town that everything is okay.
I love that. I love that. It's too bad the city council can't just pay him to keep it going.
Or at least a little bit more.
So your book highlights these, and it's really a great smattering of these examples. You chose 10 of the world's rarest and most dazzling cultural marvels that are just on the edge of extinction, and you told their stories through the last people alive who are preserving them. Let's just, as an example, and this ranges all around the world, let's talk about the living libraries of West Africa. Tell us that story.
Sure. So for more than 800 years, there is a tradition dating back to the founding of the Mali Empire. At its height in the 1300s, the Mali Empire was actually the wealthiest kingdom on the face of the planet. And when the Mali Empire was founded, the first king, whose name translated as the Lion King, for which the Disney film is actually based, bestowed to this one person a sacred instrument called a balafone. A balafone is very similar to a xylophone or to a marimba. And he gave this instrument to a person named Bala Faseke Kuyate. Bala Faseke Kuyate's job wasn't just to play the balafone, but to recite and memorize the kingdom's history. And so today, in an astonishing tradition that has lasted 27 generations, every single male in the Kuyate family has learned how to play the balafone, but has also memorized days' worth of history from the Mali Empire. As a result, much of what the world knows today about the Mali Empire is distinctly from this one family. But the original balafone that existed is still around. It's kept in a 150-person village on the border of Guinea and Mali called Nyagasola. There's no electricity, there's no running water, but the family still guards this instrument. And the heir apparent to this instrument that is considered sacred by 13 million people in West Africa is an undocumented immigrant in Medford, Massachusetts. And I sent him an email because no one had written about this person. It's an astonishing legacy. And when I sent him an email as a stranger, just hoping that I could meet him, I could go back to where this tradition began and to tell it with dignity and honesty, I got a message back from him 20 minutes later saying, I've been waiting for an email like this for 20 years.
And in a way, you're contributing to the survival of traditions and cultural threads like this with your book. Elliot Stein is the kind of travel writer who knows from firsthand experience that the world can surprise us in its riches. He's our guest right now on Travel with Rick Steves. Elliot has traveled the world from his home base in Brooklyn, looking for people who are dedicated to keeping the world's rarest and most fragile traditions alive. His book, Custodians of Wonder, comes from what he's found and written about for his custom-made column online at BBC Travel. Elliot's website includes photos from his adventures and links to his articles and book. It's at Elliot with one L, Stein.me. Elliot, there's 10 of these examples, and these are just 10 out of countless examples, I'm sure. I really enjoyed the one about the world's rarest pasta. Take us to Sardinia now and tell us about that.
Sure. I lived in Sardinia for several years, and when I was there, I heard whispers about this woman. And this is a woman named Paola Abraini. And so every morning, there's a woman there, Paola, who wakes up at 7 a.m. She slips on an apron, and she begins to make the world's rarest pasta. It's called su filindeu, which in Sardinian means the threads of God. And it's made by pulling and folding semolina dough into 256 perfectly even strands with the tips of your fingers. And then you stretch it diagonally across a circular frame in an intricate three-layer pattern. In its completed state, each frame essentially becomes a latticework of razor-thin pasta threads, so delicate, so precise, so intricately interwoven that it resembles stitched lace. And traditionally, the only way that you can eat the threads of God is to complete a 33-kilometer overnight pilgrimage from Nuoro, where Paola lives, to a pilgrim town called Lula. And at the end of this excruciating journey, you're presented with the threads of God. And it's one of the most remarkable things I've ever tasted. It's more of a stew than a soup, It's served in mutton broth with a lot of pecorino. Pecorino is actually 80% of it in the world comes from Sardinia, and this dish itself is essentially Sardinia in a bowl.
Take me now to the last Inca bridge. That's a fascinating chapter in your book.
This is one of my favorite stories from the book. The Inca Empire was one of the world's most unusual empires. It developed in near isolation, but one of the keys to its success is its road system. And it's rivaled only by the Roman road system. But unlike the Roman road system, which traversed a relatively uniform topography, the Inca wove their world together, which went from Colombia in the north down to Argentina in the south, through this road system that went from the peaks of the mountains down to the steamy depths of the Amazon rainforest. And where they couldn't bore tunnels through the mountaintops or pave it with stone, they stitched their world together by creating grass-woven suspension bridges over the canyons. At the empire's height, there were 200 grass-woven suspension bridges. Today, there's only one left, and it dangles over a rushing river in the southern highlands of Peru in a town called Huinchiri. For more than 500 years, men in the Aritzapana family have been the bridge masters overseeing the construction of this bridge. And every year in June, 1,100 people living on the rooftop of the world at 3,600 meter elevation come together for 3 days to weave grass together, overseen by the bridge master, who then thrusts himself over this canyon to connect one side of the bridge with the other. And when it's completed in its finished state, this grass-woven bridge is strong enough to support the weight of a marching army, just as it always has in the Inca Empire. And so the community together transforms these golden coils into a bridge that's as strong as steel. And the most remarkable part about this tradition is that there's actually a modern steel bridge just mere steps away from where they weave this grass-woven bridge.
That's incredible that they still do that, and it still is functional, if necessary.
It's very functional, and despite the fact that there's a modern bridge, most villagers actually prefer to cross the suspension bridge.
Oh, I would.
I did this myself, and it's utterly terrifying. It's
utterly terrifying. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're exploring the world with Elliot Stein, and he's helping us, well, he's illustrating the fragile wonders that are surviving and marveling at their importance and how on earth they continue surviving. Elliot's book is called Custodians of Wonder: Ancient Customs, Profound Traditions, and the Last People Keeping Them Alive. You can learn more about Elliot's writing and his work with this week's show notes at ricksteves.com/radio. Elliot, there's so many examples that we could talk about, but we're almost out of time. We could talk about the man trying to save the finest Japanese soy sauce. We could talk about the only democratic job in Cuba. We could talk about Asia's last film poster painter. But let's just finish with a little look in southern India at the mirror that reveals your truest self.
This is one that still haunts me. And to a certain extent, I feel like I've been lied to my whole life. I never really thought to stop and consider my own reflection. But it turns out that the mirror that I have at home and the mirror that you probably have, Rick, and that most listeners have, it's not actually a true reflection of what you look like. So in a standard glass mirror, the image that you see isn't cast from the top surface that you can tap with your finger, but from a silver or aluminum coating behind the glass. And so when light travels through that surface, hits the reflective coating, and then back out again, it causes a slight aberration or distortion, meaning that the image that you see of yourself isn't exactly how other people see you. Instead, in southern India, in the state of Kerala, on the bank of a river in a mangrove forest, this one extended family has developed an astonishing metal alloy formula that is 99.9% perfect, and we're talking NASA-level engineering. And the recipe for this metal alloy mirror has been tightly guarded for 300 years. And so it's called the Aranmula Kanadi. Aranmula is the name of the tiny pilgrimage village where it's based, and Kanadi means mirror. And what stares back at you is a perfect reflection of who you are. And so in Indian society, as in many societies, mirrors aren't just used as a way to gauge your appearance, but to look deep into yourself. This is a core belief in Hinduism, trying to unlock the God that you see within yourself. And so ever since this mirror was created, it's been considered one of the 9 sacred objects that are used in the Malabar coast that are used for religious holidays, for gifts, and it's believed to bring prosperity and luck. But it's a tightly, tightly guarded formula, so much so that only 26 people alive know the formula for this mirror. And wow. I got to witness it being made, and it is truly astonishing.
Where's my golden buzzer? That is an amazing slice of culture from an amazing corner of the world, South India. Elliot, how many of these examples do you think will still be here if you checked back in 100 years? I mean, I would say they're all on a rapid road to extinction.
I think each of these rites was on a rapid road to extinction before the pandemic. I think as the world has rapidly come together and flattened in a certain extent, their path toward extinction has only increased, only sped up. I would be surprised if any of these were here in a century, especially as they currently exist. I think that, you know, there are a lot of custodians and a lot of communities trying to modify and evolve these traditions in a more economically friendly way, whether by appealing to tourists, whether by changing where these traditions exist, trying to introduce different communities to them. But there's a fine line between maintaining a tradition and commodifying it. And I would be shocked if any of these things were still around in 100 years.
Maybe the reality is they will be extinct, but through these, appreciating these, we can see some of the beauties of different cultures. What is the practical takeaway from all of this? If somebody reads your book from cover to cover, how are they going to be better connected with our world?
Yeah, I think you've touched on something really important. You know, we lose 9 languages every year. Nearly 3,000 towns and villages in Spain are at risk of becoming depopulated. A local minister in Japan painted the risk of what he called local extinction. I think that as people increasingly speak the same languages, live in the same cities, eat the same foods, we're becoming a more homogenous species. And I think for those of us who travel to be stirred by the unfamiliar and enthralled by the boundless depths of how the natural world affects human expression, that's a shame. These sort of quiet rites remind me of how wondrously diverse and stunning the world can be. And I think when you lose these things, and when people migrate to cities more and more and kind of shed these distinct elements of who we are and where we came from, there's a certain sadness in that. And so what I'm hoping with this book is just to remind people that the world can still be a very wondrous place despite all of the doom and gloom out there. And in a certain extent, it's a celebration of the human spirit and perseverance that against all odds, these things still exist. I mean, one way of looking at it is, yes, there's a sadness in these things being lost, but at the same time, what does it say about a place like Sweden, one of the most modern industrialized nations on earth, that hundreds and hundreds of years after appointing a night watchman, this thing still exists? I think that's actually lovely and something to celebrate.
Elliot, thank you so much, because in a lot of ways, you are a custodian of wonder, which is the name of your book, and hopefully, inspired by your book, we can all become custodians of cultural wonder. Thanks, Elliot.
Thanks so much, Rick.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington, by Tim Tatton, Kazmira Hall, and Donna Bardsley. Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court upload the shows to our website. Our theme music was written and performed by Jerry Frank. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. Thanks to Gretchen Strauch for reading our listener travel haiku. Send us what you've written about your travel impressions. There's a link at ricksteves.com/radio.